Hey everyone, you're listening to Pacific Underground. On today's show, we're going to be featuring a live recording from White Noise Project's most recent event, Remembering Qantas Haze. So joining me in studio is Jake Vermas, co-founder of White Noise Project and also a Pacific Underground producer.
Hi.
So Jake, why don't you tell us a little bit about what White Noise Project is?
All right. White Noise Project is a reading and discussion series to amplify writers of color and folks from underrepresented communities.
So your most recent event took place on February 16th, and it was marking the one-year anniversary of the killing of Qantas Haze here in Portland.
Yes, it was 1 year and a week after Qantas was shot and killed by Portland police. And we held the event partnering with Teresa Rayford from Don't You Portland, as well as Glenn Waco, a local MC, grew up in Portland, and two local writers, African-American writers who also grew up in Portland, Jamila Osman and Kalima Abioto.
So why don't we just get right into the recording from the live event. Jake, people are first going to hear the voice of Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland. And can you describe for us what she is talking about, what people are going to be hearing?
So the first portion of the evening was just to give each reader a chance to share work, an essay or poem. And in Teresa's case, it was in response to a question that I'd asked about the purpose of activist art in public discourse.
You'll also hear Teresa in this opening part of the event reference a recent shooting, which is the Parkland shooting in Florida, because this event happened 2 days after the shooting.
And then we have an essay from Jamila Osman, and then finally a poem from Kalima Abioto.
Thank you for having me, and I just wanted to say that maybe we should take a moment of silence for Qantas Haze in his honor. Thank you. I just also wanted to just mention, and we all know that there's been several tragedies over the last 36 hours. A lot of children have been horrified at the situations at their schools, and this has been happening across the country, and we've lost a lot of lives, and so I just wanted to be mindful of that and why we are here today in honor of a 17-year-old child that also lost his life to gun violence in this country. Just in response to what the brother said about art and activism and political activism, as someone who grew up in Portland and who looked at art as an escape from a lot of the trauma that I grew up with, not only as a child that grew up in the foster care system, but in that system was badly abused along with my brothers and sisters. But art had always been an escape for us. The reality in my life is that when we're able to utilize art not only as a freedom of expression to express ourselves when we're fighting for political activism or change, it's the safest thing that you have when you live in poverty. It's the safest thing that you have when you're marginalized, because people don't see your life as a priority. They don't see that the issues that you're speaking about because of your placement in class, they don't see that your direct engagement to those issues absolutely matters. And so when we use art as a function of revealing ourselves to people in society that might be able to have more power to create more of an influence of change, it's the only spectrum that matters. It's the only one that has weight attached to it. And so we use it, and we use it broadly, and we use it boldly, and we use it loudly. And sometimes we use it to the detriment of our own safety, but it is, again, the only safety net that is available to us as people that live in poverty, the people that have no voice, those voiceless people. And a lot of artists understand that, because when they want to make art, they don't care what it takes to get there. They don't wait for the monetary opportunity to create what is inside of them in order to make the world understand who they are. And we can't wait, because our lives are what we're fighting for. And so we don't have the luxury of time in order to get these things done. And so when people want to deflect that our efforts have no basis in a cultural paradigm or any artistic manner, then they just don't hear us. And so that's just what I got to say about it.
Thank you, Carissa. Yeah, so tonight we're really excited to have some artists that are going to perform and hold some space with us. We have Jamila Osman, Kalima Abioto, and also Glenn Waco.
This is for Moose, for Trayvon, and for all of the children that have been stolen from us because of state violence. I wrote this on Trayvon Martin's birthday. Trayvon Martin would have been 23 years old today. His death was my first heartbreak. My heart had been cracked prior, sure. What black girl living in this empire could exit girlhood whole? But Trayvon's death broke my heart wide open. I cried for days. I saw his face every time I looked at my brothers. I saw his face any time I thought of the black men who called me daughter, sister, lover, friend. Every black man looked like a ghost to me. Every black mother, including my own, a woman atoning for this nation's sins. When I returned from Palestine this summer, I had an email from my friend Lucy. She said, Palestine is a beautiful place, both as a place and as a state of mind. So filled it is with wounds and displacement, it can cradle anyone's wounds with the love and persistence for life that our situation forces us to undertake. Lucy's words meant the world to me. Palestine taught me how vital it is to have a love and a persistence for life, not despite the horrors of the world, but precisely because of them. My mother said my time away changed me, but how could I return home in August the same person that I was when I left at the start of that summer? How could I witness the dignity of the Palestinian resistance and not be moved by the beauty of the human spirit? The spirit cannot be conquered. History has shown us this time and again. Patrice Lumumba said he had an unshakable faith in a free Congo. In a letter he wrote to his wife once, he said, I know and feel in my very heart of hearts that sooner or later my people will rid themselves of all their enemies, foreign and domestic, that they will rise up as one to say no to the shame and degradation of colonialism and regain their dignity in the pure light of day. What a gift it is to believe in freedom. A year after Trayvon's death, I was sitting in the living room with my father when George Zimmerman was found not guilty of his murder. What does this mean? I kept asking my father. Suddenly, English was not a language I understood. Guilty? Not guilty? Justice? What did any of those words mean? A 17-year-old boy was dead. Everything else was spectacle. I was in graduate school learning how to become a teacher at the time. I sat in a class full of people who were also learning to become teachers. Everyone talked about their weekends, and I hated each of my peers for their indifference. How was your weekend? The professor asked me. Trayvon Martin is dead, and no one is guilty. I excused myself and went to the bathroom to cry. In 2014, Michael Brown was shot in Missouri and Ferguson erupted. They called it a riot, but it was an uprising. The ruling class is always manipulating language to obscure the truth. We marched and protested in Portland. We met in churches and community rooms to organize against police brutality in our own city. We were riveted by the courage of our comrades in Ferguson. There were images of burning cop cars on the news. And I wanted to see 100 cop cars set aflame. I wanted those fires to burn forever. I wanted them to keep our loved ones warm in the cold of that winter's rage. The National Guard was deployed to maintain peace and order. The streets were swarming with riot cops. They tear gassed and pepper sprayed civilians. They threw flash grenades into crowds of people. Palestinians took to the internet in solidarity with protesters and gave them advice on how to protect themselves from police violence during these times. There is a photo that I will never forget from those weeks of protests. A man is standing on the Brooklyn Bridge holding up a sign. From Ferguson to Gaza, Intifada, Intifada. This was the summer before my first year of teaching. I was still angry at the indifference of my peers who could cover their mouths in horror at the sight of a Bank of America with its windows smashed in, but shrug at the image of Michael Brown's dead body. It was early August when he died and he would have started school in just 2 days. I will never cry over broken windows in a country that has broken so many of our hearts. I knew from a young age that America was not my country. I knew this when I was 7 at the store with my mother, and an old white man told her to go back to her country. I knew this when I was in 4th grade, and my teacher accused me of cheating on my math test, even though I was one of the smartest kids in my class. I knew this post 9/11 when the United States went to war with Iraq, and my uncle went to jail, and they called him a terrorist, and when men we knew from the masjid began to disappear. I knew this when drone strikes killed poor brown people in that part of the world. One people's idea of collateral damage is another people's idea of kin. I knew I didn't belong here, but it wasn't until Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and Eric Gardner and Rakia Boyd and Ahed Tamimi and Tamir Rice and Ferguson and Baltimore and Palestine and Libya and Syria and Honduras and Portland that I realized I belonged wherever people gathered in the name of justice. Wherever people spoke truth was my country. And Somalia was my country first, the country where my ancestors fought a brutal colonial regime so they could one day fly a flag of their own. When my sister Ayan died, I felt guilty to be alive. For a long time afterwards, I did whatever I could to end up wherever she was. You can't go with her, my mother kept telling me, but I wanted to, more than I had ever wanted anything else. I miss my sister in a language that has not yet been spoken. I miss her with an intensity that often catches me off guard. I remember a few months after her death, I put on eyeliner and felt guilty, so I wiped it off while it was still wet. That's how my mother found me, in front of the bathroom mirror, the black kohl smeared across my face and the back of my hand. I can't wear eyeliner, I said. Ayan is dead. I felt guilty every time that I laughed. Someone would look at me and say the word love, and I would run like a skittish cat. What right did I have to beauty? What right did I have to joy? I know now this doesn't make sense, but I didn't know this at the time. Once, my grandmother told me stories about all the women she knew who fell in love and got married and had children during the most brutal years of the Somali Civil War. I do not share this to glamorize their strength or to put them on pedestals for doing what all women from countries like mine have always done. I share this because it makes clear to me a lesson that I am finally beginning to learn. We must, at all times, and against all odds, insist on our right to life. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to welcome Kalima Abioto.
I've been moving up and down this train. I've been trying to know my name. I've been moving up and down this train. I've been trying to know my name. They say a new king is born today. Fresh boy, new boy, heart boy, joy boy, fresh born, newborn, heart born, joy born. Someone take him outside. Lift his head up. His arms, his chest, raise his back. Let him see the stars. You are my cousin, man. You are my sister. You are my mother. And you are me. You are my grandfather. Moving wind speed forward. Ready in revelry. Readying yourself for self-discovery. Some said you were an ugly baby, but the sun saw your determination. A quick wit, you are never waiting for what's already yours. Move a boy, shake a boy, trust a boy, send a boy, too. Twist and turn your head to the heavens. Twist and turn your head to the heavens. This happening ain't simple. This happening is not simple. It's complicated. It's complicated, this life. But you deserve better. I raise my glass to you, my cute. I raise my glass to you, my cute. My brother, my sister, my mother, and sometimes, yes, my father too. A sinner and a lover like me. Same bread, same bread, same bread. I've been running up and down this train, trying to know my name.
Thank you. At this point in the live event, you guys actually played a clip from another radio station from OPUB. Can you tell us a little bit about what was in that clip?
Yes, that was an interview with Quanis's mother and his cousin Terrence. And what we found powerful with that, and the reason that we played it, is so that his family could get a chance to speak and take up space at the event, which was sort of in support of them, but they could not make it. So in that way, rather than people not of the family, you know, taking up all the airtime and all the, you know, we made sure to make space for them and their voice. Yeah. So coming up next, you're going to hear a roundtable discussion facilitated by Ryan Nakano and with Teresa, Glenn, and Jamila. And then following that, you have the final performance of Glenn Waco.
Which, if you tuned into our live radio show, we actually had technical difficulties and weren't able to play the entirety of. So if you're a radio listener, you can hear the end of Glenn Waco's commentary, along with him doing some freestyle and performing at the end. So the first voice you're going to hear is Ryan Nakano, and he mentions the OPB clip in reference to media and how...
The narrative.
Yeah, why it's important to discuss what we call something, how we name something. And, you know, when the news came out first about Quanis Hayes, we saw that the mainstream media really shaped a narrative that removed the humanity of this child.
And immediately dictated who the reader or listener is supposed to have sympathy for in
this. The public narrative.
Yeah. We're supposed to believe this narrative of white innocence, mm-hmm. when it's more complicated than that.
It's just racism.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or it's like a really not so complicated but simple idea that people deserve their humanity and oppressions like racism need to be recognized in order for people to get justice.
And called out for what they are.
So here's Ryan Nakano.
Kind of place I wanted to start was there's a poet who basically has said it matters what you call a thing, right? And we
Soulmaz Sharif.
Yeah, Soulmaz Sharif. She says it matters what you call a thing. And just in that interview, we hear Terrence talk about you know whether when we're listening to these stories in the media, how these things are being construed, the language that's being used. And he even makes that distinction himself. He says, I'm going to call it what it is. And I was hoping we could kind of speak about the importance of language, especially when it comes to our own writing and our own art. And sort of, how important it is that we kind of reflect language that is true and real.
I think that language is the means by which like white supremacy, you know, can exist. Like things on that vibration can exist because you can manipulate language in so many different ways to where you don't have to be so blunt. You can mask it. And I think that's important to note and an important thing to keep in the back of your mind, because when you look at what just happened with this election cycle, that's exactly what happened. You know, white supremacists were able to politicize their agenda and created a whole political platform and was able to infiltrate the political spectrum and infiltrate FBI and schools and all of these institutions. And now that we have kids being indoctrinated in shooting schools. So language is very important. And I think with all the negatives said, us as artists, us as creatives, us as activists, us as human beings, I think that music is the means by which I communicate my message. But if you're a creative, you know, and you have a platform to say something, whatever the mediums by which you translate your message, is like that's going to be the language. Like the art is the language by which you speak. So I think that language has shaped history. Like they still teach lies in history about Christopher Columbus, for instance. That's an example. They choose what not to teach. You know, that's all language and that's all programming. And I think that we can get some game off of that and learn from that and develop our own programming. And I think that we should focus more so on the kids, because the kids are going to be soaking all of this up. And I think that's at the root of how you fix this as a kid.
So I agree with Glenn. I think language is tremendously important. I think language is a site of struggle, particularly because those in power can manipulate language to obscure the truth and to obscure reality. Like from the inception of this country, right? Like calling colonization discovery, after the Florida shooting, this man that I worked with said, oh, they found out that the shooter was part of like a far right group. It was a white supremacist group, call it what it is. And so that there's tremendous power in naming or not naming something. And so I think that those of us that do art, those of us that do write, our job is to tell the truth, whatever that means. And to call things what they are all the time, regardless of the pushback that we get for doing that.
Yeah, and in my opinion, a lot of times what I had to find power in was politics and the use of politics, because when I was first injured by trauma and I felt the need to fight back, what I had to realize was that the commanding of knowledge meant that you could command language. It meant that you could understand language and you could utilize language not only to provide testimony, but also to articulate demands to people that have political power. And the only way to have your voice at the table was to speak the same language that was being dictated as the resolution for making things happen at the table. And so I started managing my use of language in a way that I would use those components and promote civic engagement and community engagement. And I would show our community that the everyday issues that they had, whether they were relative to housing or criminal justice or suicide, domestic violence, whatever those issues was, the way that people would dictate that language to me as an advocate, I would help them formulate it so that it could dictate process in the way that they were treated in dealing with that stress or that trauma. And I wanted it to stick so that it could become a blueprint, so that they could utilize their situation to become self-advocates and also community advocates, and not to leave it there, but to take it into state and legislative politics. And all of this just taking the command of community engagement, being the strongest vessel of changing the situation and not letting a gatekeeper situation or an agency be the voice of that people, but to take the voice back and to give that voice back to the people through using acquisition of language.
Oh, yeah, and also I think that an important thing to take away from that interview regarding language is paying attention to like the language of the police and the language of how they portray, you know, black criminals versus white criminals. You know, just the type of words they use to describe one, or to describe Trayvon Martin, to describe Mike Brown, versus a domestic terrorist that shoots up a school that just so happens to be a white supremacist. It's a very distinct difference, and they always use the aspect of a criminality, like he's a criminal, so should we not care about his life because he committed a crime? Everybody, I'm pretty sure, I don't know the statistics, but I'm pretty sure a lot of people in America commit crimes. That doesn't give the state, you know, litigation to just take somebody's life, because that's how you wind up with fascism. And I don't think we want to live in a fascist country. And, you know, that's a very deep-rooted thing in America, to portray a black body as a weapon. Like you're weaponizing a dead body at the end of the day. You're weaponizing a child's existence against himself. Like he was hands up, you know, on his knees. That's an assassination. And if we get to a spot to where we allow them to mask language and to cover their actions, then we're in a world of trouble. We need to call it what it is. It's white supremacist. It's not white now. It's white supremacist. That's what it is. And I think that, yeah, to speak truth to power, like, that's very important. Thank you.
Can I add one more thing? And I think that, like, we've inherited this language, and so it's really important for us to, like, really, to, like, not let them define these words for us and for us to unpack this language whenever possible. Like, why should they be able to tell us, like, who is a criminal and who is not a criminal? Like, why should they be able to tell us, like, who is a terrorist and who is not a terrorist? And so instead of taking these words and using them without any sort of analysis or understanding, like, we really do have to unpack the way that they wield language against us.
Thank you. I guess the one other thing I did want to bring up that kind of came to mind when I was listening to the interview was this idea of speaking for the other. It was said in the interview that, you know, Qantas was not here to defend himself. Their voice is not here, right? And especially coming from a like poetry and writing background, the idea of kind of speaking for the other, speaking for from not your maybe not your personal experience, but for a community. I'm just kind of interested in that idea and what you all think about that when it pertains to kind of activism and art. As far as activism and art goes, it's okay.
I mean, it's the same as what I've been watching over the last couple of nights on CNN. Like, I literally could not turn my TV off because I was all the way back in 2013 with Sandy Hook, and 2012 with Clackamas Town Center, and then even further back with 2010 and my nephew. I was just glued to it because I couldn't really like fathom after a month in Portland. Like in the month of January, 7 people got killed in our community. by gun violence, and they call it gang violence or whatever, but these are crimes that are committed in our community. And then by February, the first week, there have been two more murders. And so by the time this happened, being a first responder, it was just way too much for me. And so just watching the news and trying to grasp and understand what was happening, it was just incredible in the reality of hearing that there were 17 people that were murdered whose names we didn't have, but to watch the news and the people dictating the narrative speak to the mental health and the stability and the need to make sure that this child was okay and that, you know, he wasn't a terrorist. I mean, they were basically saying he is not a terrorist. This is not what this is. He got expelled last year. This is, you know, they basically created a narrative from their own understanding of what was happening. But the reality of what happened within the next 36 hours was that not only did he premeditate this opportunity, but he had on his ROTC uniform, and he was basically making a statement and debunking their whole strategy for safety in the schools. And so, and even prioritized, you know, blueprinting this, calculated, you know, statements on social media that could be found and that could be, you know, researched and should have been investigated. And then not to mention the 39 plus times that the police were called out to his house for domestic violence and abuse against parents and elders and animals and all of the different things that were major red flags. And to think during all of this time that people were still seeking understanding, and knowing that in the work that I do, that the children that are murdered don't even get a day in court. We don't get to know anything about them except for that they should not have breathed that day. They should not have played outside that day. They should not have moved that day. They should not have spoke. They should not have something. Like, they were in the wrong for being murdered that day. But we're supposed to be so empathetic to someone that just took away 17 lives. And we still didn't understand why, but we had to transfix ourselves to understand a narrative that was telling us that we would be inhuman if we thought that gun violence or gun legislation or anything political should mandate our thought process before we understand the need to empathize with someone who premeditated the killing of 17 people. That's powerful when you own the platform that can suggest such disgusting varieties of emotional content. You got my answer. If you didn't, I don't know.
Talk about art and activism.
Yeah, and just this idea of like, this idea of speaking for the other, right, and speaking through your art about maybe things that you're not necessarily experiencing, but it's
it's like, I just, when I look at Quanis, man, like, I'm just going to keep this on Quanis. When I look at Quanis, I see my little brother, I see my little cousin, I see, you know, my little brother's friends and stuff. Like, these are kids, like, that grew up in the community. Like, it's just hard for me not to say anything and not to try to put something, you know what I'm saying, into my music to where I can really just help people, you know what I'm saying? Like, again, if you're creative and you have this platform to say something and you have all of this going on in the community, if you're silent, I think that, like, you're complicit with it at this point, because it's like, it's a lot of trauma that we're dealing with. It's a lot of trauma in our community, and I think that's at the root of a lot of issues. And with this case, man, it's like, he basically got murdered for being poor. Let's say he did rob somebody of an EBT card. That boy was probably hungry. What is the condition that led to that instant is the questions that need to be asked. Not looking for reasons of justifying the murder of a 17-year-old kid. Like, just to know the history of this country and to see how we've been confined to poverty and know that poverty equals crime and how the redistribution of wealth in this country is going on right now, the redistribution of resources to where people are basically being kicked out of their home, out of their neighborhoods at this point, relocated. All these resources are being, you know, reallocated, and you're basically being confined to this condition of a constant state of fear, anger, and survival. So it's like, I don't even know what I'm trying to say right now. I hope that makes sense. But I think that we need to start looking to the roots of this, and we need to start projecting this in our art. And, you know, hopefully that answered your question. That's my answer.
I think that, like, beyond identity, these superstructures oppress all of us, even if it is to varying degrees. And so what we have to recognize is that, like, my freedom is bound completely to everyone's freedom in this room. And so then if we know that and we live, like, that's our principle that guides us and that we live by, then, like, how can Kwanis and his mother and his family, like, how can they be other to me, right? Like, they're nothing but mirrors of myself and my own family and my community. And so, like, we have to see each other as mirrors, right? And then there is no other. Like, how can somebody that I'm in complete solidarity with be other to?
Thank you so much for being up here and having this conversation. In the interest of time, I do want to give space for Glenn to do his thing. So thank you again.
So the book, that's the fifth shooting just this week. Somebody blessed, let this live in hell so discreet. So to speak, we ain't surprised, that's just how it goes. We live to die, thought of living long's getting old, lean with the drope, I be poking with the coke. These endorphins for these orphans fill the lungs within the smoke. They can smoke, we go post emojis, rest in peace, emotion, shakes the trauma with these henny slow, so we don't know the dose. Influenced by shit that kill us softly, call us influenza. These words we rhyme, but be the cause, will be the influencer. This war we fought with pride so blindly, left us in the center, pinned against each other, my nigga, you don't see the agenda. This mentality keep us stuck in the loop. It's all we see, it's all we know, so it's gonna be all we do. In these conditions, they tend to grow roots. I see it, think it's cool. Now our roots, pinnacles, drowning inside of this pint, 100 proof. Fucking baby. So I made this song about Asada Shakur. You know, she was a political activist, a former Black Panther. She's Tupac Shakur's auntie. And she was basically accused of shooting a New Jersey state trooper, and they actually wound up shooting her with her hands up. And long story short, they tortured her in her hospital bed. They tried to get her to confess to something she didn't do, despite medical forensic evidence proving her side. And she spent years in solitary confinement in men's prisons. And I believe that knowing the history of the people in the past and the sacrifice that have gone on for so long up to this point, we're living in a very important time where we could really affect some real stuff. We could really help a lot of people. And I think that we all could be activists. And being activists don't mean holding a banner or holding a bullhorn. You know, being an activist simply means being active in whatever you're pursuing in life, and being, we're all human beings, and move from a place of humanity, and that's my message in my music, and that's what I'm trying to push. So make some noise for that one time.
This stuff for the one that got away, one we left a dead, and the one we gotta say, framed by the pigs way back in Jersey. The only thing you're really free to do is serve. So you fight for your rights and you stand. Watch out for the man, on drugs to your man. Guns in your hand, yes, mantle. Go and tell, bro. Don't be opening any letters, send this to go and tell, bro. Whip the chains, consider around waiting for the shit to change. The point figures now that here's the plane. Solid didn't fight, just a shift the blame. Please hitting off a murder, nobody pushing her brother. Must have lost you, found him, a murder. Killed off all leaders, all the people respect. Violence, see the beat, only thing you respect.
watch news clips today. America and all, I got some shit to say. See, terror breeds terror. You just drop bombs. Some others in the kids, yeah, just today. But shit, I don't wanna talk right now. Took another bullet to my heart right now. So, Aquinas got my niggas, so they get you. They women see this, mama get the news, yeah, it's all right now. With the change, with the change. The American way, like, with the change. Kill Aquinas, but you'll never get a sudden. Kill Bobby, but you'll never get a sudden. With the change.
Because if everything that we talk about and everything that we do just stays here, there's no point. Like, we got to take this to social media. We got to have this conversation with our families, with our friends, and really get behind this family. This was the community, son. So I really encourage everybody to continue this dialogue outside of this building. Love.
You were just listening to a recording from the White Noise Project's February 16th event, Remembering Aquinas Hayes, featuring Teresa Rayford, Glenn Waco, Kalima Abioto, and Jamila Osman. And we put links to their social media and how you can find some of their work on the show page, which you can find at kboo.fm.
And yeah, we've also included a link to the Crowd Justice fundraising site that's Justice for Aquinas Hayes.
I don't think anything could be added on top of what Glenn said about not letting it stop at the event, just kind of carrying that awareness and that you know, call to action into our lives.
Like you're saying, you know, we need to be listening to that kind of advice that Glenn Waco was just saying, that you need to not just passively sit back, you know, and let going to White Noise Project or listening to this show feel like you're doing enough, that you need to keep taking actionable steps and doing tangible things and actually disrupting oppressive words.
Right. sharing, using your resources to support people's campaigns, using your presence and your privilege to interrupt oppressive language, and, you know, sometimes also using where you're placed to vote and write letters to the editor, write, use your best, I want to see your manager voice.
Yeah, definitely just using whatever resources you have when you need to disrupt things, and then also knowing when you have privilege and learning to step back to make space. You know, we don't want to be taking up too much space here, like literally right now on our show, but at the same time, we also have had discussions about how important it is for people to talk to their own communities. So our quick message to our own community is take action.
Don't just sit with that model minority status.
Yeah, it's one of
question
the...
Question that.
Yeah, question it, because it is literally oppressive to all other communities as long as we continue to ignore that we're model minorities and that, you know, it's that wedge. So thanks, Shake, for sharing that audio from your most recent event. And definitely, you know, thank you so much to all the speakers from that night. Definitely check out our website to learn more about Justice for Qantas Hayes.
Thanks for listening.